My fellow plebs, River is setting a new standard in Bitcoin. At river.com, you'll pay zero fees when you dollar cost average. Truly the best way to build your Bitcoin wealth. All Bitcoin at River is held in secure cold storage with 100% full reserves. There's no need to wonder what's happening behind the scenes. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. Additionally, River lets you make Bitcoin payments via the Lightning Network, offers a Lightning integration for developers, and allows you to mine Bitcoin directly to your River account. River has a level of service that is unheard of in this industry, including phone support, private client advisors, and the ability to designate beneficiaries to inherit your Bitcoin wealth. River has become the premium name in Bitcoin that anyone can easily access. Sure, you have a place to buy Bitcoin, but have you tried River? See and feel the difference at river.com and the River iOS app, the preferred partner of Bitcoin Magazine. Over the last 5 years, the Bitcoin Conference has become the world's largest gathering of Bitcoiners. From breaking announcements and international media coverage to countless meaningful talks by thought leaders and industry innovators, we are excited to continue our drive for global hyper-Bitcoinization. From July 25th to the 27th, 2024, we'll be taking the Bitcoin Conference to the city of Music and Freedom, Nashville, Tennessee. Join thousands of attendees for countless opportunities to learn, engage, and network across 3 days of pure Bitcoin signal. Get your tickets now for the best price at b.tc/conference. You are not going to want to miss what Nashville has in store. My fellow plebs, Bitcoin Magazine is headed back to Amsterdam in 2023. We're returning to Westergaas to build on this historic success and continue our mission of global hyper-Bitcoinization. In its inaugural year, Bitcoin Amsterdam was the biggest European Bitcoin event in history. Held from October 12th to the 14th in 2022 at Westergaas Event Forum, nearly 3,000 attendees jumped at the opportunity to learn, engage, and party with fellow Bitcoiners. 126 brilliant speakers from all over Europe and beyond took the stage to represent different angles and present various perspectives. Offering 6 different on-site locations and 3 fully programmed stages, we are absolutely stoked to catapult the European community to the global stage. Tickets are at their lowest prices right now. Block yours in at b.tc/conference/Amsterdam. That's b.tc/conference/Amsterdam.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Hey Kelly, doing great, man. CK and I are really stoked to have you here. Appreciate you taking the time to join us and really excited to share with our audience your work on Bitcoin urbanism. It's been really fascinating to see what a more decentralized future of urban organization might look like. So it should be a blast.
Well, I'm happy to be here, happy to talk about it, and happy to answer questions as we go.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah. So CK, if you're ready to get going, I guess feel free to kick us off here and then, you know, introduce the show and I'll go ahead, give our audience a little background on Kelly and then we'll fire away.
All right. Let's start off with a little bit of housekeeping and then we're going to get into this fascinating conversation about Bitcoin urbanism. What does that even mean? Well, you know, y'all, this Cosmic Spaces is all about diving into the bigger ideas surrounding Bitcoin. It's more than just money. It is a lifestyle. It is a way of moving into the future. All of us think about how Bitcoin can affect the future, and Cosmic Bitcoin is about bringing together the thinkers that make Bitcoin possible, the thinkers that push Bitcoin to the future and that, you know, think a little bit differently about this crazy, you know, changing dynamic that we're living with that is Bitcoin. So really excited to get into this one. We are on this show on Bitcoin Magazine Spaces, as well as later after we go live on Bitcoin Magazine Podcast. We broadcast on Spaces every single Wednesday from 6 to 7 Eastern. I believe that is 3 to 4 Pacific. So y'all, come join us every single week. We're trying to keep it interesting every single week. This week is especially interesting, and this show is brought to you by the Bitcoin Conference. So everyone knows Bitcoin 2024 next year, more than a year out in Nashville. It's going to be a great time. Thousands of Bitcoiners already purchased tickets, so it's going to be one of the biggest events in the world, and it's in the Bitcoin world, it's going to be one of the biggest events ever. Definitely the biggest in 2024. But before that, we got Bitcoin Amsterdam. So Bitcoin Amsterdam is October 12th through the 13th, an absolutely incredible event. We announced our first two speakers today, Stella Assange and JB55, the creator of Domus. So getting off to a hot start, less than 110 days away. It'll be soon, be less than 100 days until Bitcoin Amsterdam. So come see us in Amsterdam, October 12th and the 13th. We're going to get Cosmic there as well. The Cosmic Times happen on stage at the event and in the cafes and bars after the event in Amsterdam. So one of the best places to have those conversations with Bitcoiners. So again, come join us there. Y'all can use promo code COSMIC. Save yourself some money. Ticket prices for Bitcoin Amsterdam are going up this Friday. So we will be leaving the pre-sale stage. So get them now. And I actually highly recommend the Bitcoin 24 Bitcoin Amsterdam bundle. For less than going to another event in the space, you can get two Bitcoin conference tickets, Bitcoin Amsterdam and Bitcoin 2024. So this is the cheapest time to get both tickets together. It's probably never going to happen again. So I will shut up now, and I'm going to pass it over to Spencer to give Kelly a warm introduction to Cosmic Bitcoin.
Awesome. Thank you, CK. Yeah, we're really glad to have CK, you back on the show as well this week. And then, you know, very excited to have Kelly too. And so just a little bit of background. Kelly is the Vice President of Development at Del Pueblo Communities in Scottsdale. They're a real estate developer focused on residential real estate in the greater Phoenix area. So Kelly has a lot of firsthand experience on what, I guess, the built environments is all about, kind of the hurdles and pitfalls as it relates to the modern bureaucratic, centrally planned urban environment. And so I think that's something we're gonna unpack as well. But Kelly is also a Bitcoiner and the author of Bitcoin Urbanism on Substack. Have that pinned up in the nest right there, and really recommend everyone go check that out. He offers a really interesting perspective, obviously drawing on his experience about how we got here, how our urban center, why our urban centers look like they do today, as well as, you know, what suburbia, where that came from, and, you know, what the future might hold as we enter a new Bitcoin era. A lot of this ties into the financialization of real estate, as well as time preference and how we construct our environments. So I'm really excited for this. And as well, just kind of a fun fact, Kelly, I saw that you are a cowboy as well at Four of a Kind Ranch in Lakeside, Arizona. So I thought that was just a fun little tidbit. And also something I do want to kind of explore today is, you know, the importance of nature in our built environment. I think that's something that people can understand as being important. But, you know, as we've paved over so much of it with our roadways, I think that that could be an interesting place to take things. But yeah, without further ado, Kelly, welcome to the show, man. Is there anything else that you'd like to share about your background and before we jump in?
You know, not really, Spencer. I wanted to thank you for doing wonderful background research. I would just add that, you know, where I work now is a family business, and I've worked here since basically I could be grounded. I always tell people I never got grounded. I just got sent to the job site. So I've had my fair share of time in a ditch and my fair share of time sweeping streets in Phoenix in July when it's 120 degrees outside. So I'm happy to be here, but I think you got all of it, and I can confirm that I am a cowboy. My family has a beef ranch located in northern Arizona and a farm in southern Arizona. So we raise about, I think right now we have about 200 head of cattle. So I'm on the strict steak diet only. But yeah, no, I'm happy to be here, happy to discuss my experience growing up and doing my day job and combining that with Bitcoin.
Awesome. Yeah, looking forward to getting into this. And so I guess a good place to start might be, you know, what is Bitcoin urbanism? Like, what inspired you to start writing about Bitcoin in the built environment? And then, you know, once we address that, we can kind of unpack, you know, what is the built environment and why it's important?
So I guess to kind of start from the beginning, I've always been a fan of, I don't want to say, you know, I didn't know what it was called at the time, but it was basically older cities or ski towns or these little kind of tourist spots that you would go visit, whether it was going to New York City, Greenwich Village, or going places like Telluride or Park City. And I just never really understood, you know, why do things look the way that they do on Main Street? And why doesn't my Main Street, you know, and where I'm from in Scottsdale look like that? So having been a developer and a builder, we build kind of apartments and townhomes and condos, stuff like that. I was just I just wanted to know why I couldn't build, you know, one of the things, one of the buildings I saw like in Park City, one of my favorite buildings ever was there. So I kind of started digging into it, and that's when I found Strong Towns. And for those who aren't familiar with Strong Towns, the guy who started it, Charles Marone, basically started asking questions like, why do we build this way and how much does it cost us and are we producing any wealth? And in his discovery, the answer was basically, no, we're not even building wealth. We're actually actively destroying it. So that was prior to me, I guess, jumping in Bitcoin both feet. I will admit to have been I was a shitcoiner for probably about a year and a half before, you know, like everybody else, I lost a bunch of money and then got into Bitcoin, finally started understanding it. I'd always been into kind of Austrian economics, but I guess I never really put two and two together until probably 2017, 2018, when the Bitcoin standard came out. So from there, it was kind of just like a meeting of two separate minds, right? So it was my real estate knowledge and experience and the things that I wanted to see combined with, you know, what sound money could produce and what it, you know, more specifically what it could limit. So that's kind of where, you know, I started kicking ideas around about, well, if we live in an environment that's totally fiat, what is an environment that's, you know, sound look like? And that's what birthed Bitcoin urbanism. So the idea is, what does the built environment look like when you are limited in your ability to build things on a sound money standard?
Yeah, I love it. And, you know, really looking forward to unpacking the difference between, you know, the fiat mindset as it relates to urban development versus the sound money mindset. And we're going to kind of talk about, you know, some of the history behind that. But I think also it'd be good just to kind of lay out, like, what is the importance of the built environment? And I know you've referenced a book before called Cognitive Architecture, and it kind of unpacks the psychological importance of, you know, the environments that we inhabit on our psyche and kind of, you know, what the importance really of like beauty and complexity and patterns is. And, you know, like, I know you've just kind of drawn a lot of examples of, you know, the old world and kind of the like Gothic churches as being, you know, highly beautiful and intricate. And, you know, that can obviously be juxtaposed quite well with like kind of the tract homes, like very monoculture type of development that we have today. So I would just be curious, like, you know, could you walk us through a little bit, like why the built environment is important for humans? Like what does that do to us, the places that we inhabit?
So we are, as humans, social creatures. We, you know, for the most of us, I can't speak for all Bitcoiners, but we would like to be around other people. We like to socialize. We like to do things. We like to provide value to earn a living. And you've got to do it somewhere. We exist on a physical plane, and we need shelter essentially in order to survive. So over time, basically since, you know, we settled down into an agrarian culture, we started exploring how to build our towns and villages and all of these things. So that's kind of the beginning of what the built environment is. The built environment is essentially the city around you. It's the buildings, the sidewalks, the bus stops, parks, trees, you know, all of these things that exist in your physical life that, you know, you don't really think of when you're going around living. So over time, we've tried to design places that we enjoy being in, right? So the book that you referenced, Cognitive Architecture, explores how humans react subconsciously in an evolved framework, and that there are certain elements of the design and construction of the built environment that essentially please your brain, right? So an easy way to explain it is that if you were looking, you know, if you were standing in a town square, I don't know, say in Rome, and you were looking around at all the buildings that are, you know, hundreds of years old, they were designed in a specific manner so that it would essentially be pleasing to the brain. Now, of course, they didn't have the ability to scientifically prove any of this stuff, but they were just kind of like, well, we built it. It looks nice. I feel good. And therefore, it is good. That was kind of how they did it. Now, today we have the ability to, you know, strap MRI, or, you know, strap you into an MRI, show you pictures, and then record all of that. And that's kind of what that book explores. So when we switch over from, you know, a sound money standard, so say like the Gilded Age or the Belle Epoque, to a semi-fiat age, we kind of get things like modernism or the early versions of modernism. And then from there, when we get full fiat, you know, you have what you live in today, essentially. So if you live in a modern American city today, there's basically giant rectangle glass squares everywhere, right? From a perspective of pleasing the brain, you couldn't get anything that was more ignorant, right? So your brain essentially ignores corners and straight lines. So if you're looking at a brand new tower, let's say like the Goldman Sachs Tower, is basically just a giant, you know, piece of glass standing on the middle of a block. Your brain literally ignores all of that. Whereas if you were, you know, looking at the Viennese Opera House, there's all sorts of details that keep your brain occupied and trigger essentially pleasure centers in your brain. Now, the other way to think about it is that buildings like the Viennese Opera House are designed to appeal to you from different distances. So if you were across the street, it'll look different than when you're standing in front of it, or if you're five blocks away. So there's a lot of thought that went into designing old buildings and trying to please the mind, because the idea is, you know, if you're going to be there all the time, you might as well be looking at something that you like to look at. And where we are today, it's essentially the exact opposite. That's for a multitude of reasons, but that's where we are.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And I guess like what I also, you know, before we dive a little bit deeper into, you know, kind of what modern urban planning has done to the types of buildings we construct and, you know, what a sound money standard was able to do for the types of environments we constructed back in the day, I guess it'd be good for our audience to know, like, what's your experience today? Like, why is it we can't build buildings like we used to? I know you talk a lot about the bureaucracy, you know, the zoning restrictions, things like that. So like, you know, could you walk us through like, why is it so hard for us to build beautiful when we could do so with lesser technology back in the day?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Spencer. So today, building really anything smaller than like, you know, a shed or a gazebo in your backyard is essentially an approval process. So you've got to go and, it's a permission process. So you have to go and ask permission in order to build it. Now, depending on what you're building, there may be more or less permissions required, but it's all permissioned regardless. So let's say that I want to build you a new house, Spencer. So you hire me, I'm the developer. You say, here's my lot. What I'll do is I'll go down to the city. I'll say, this is what we want to do. What are our limitations? They'll give me my limitations and I say, okay. So then I hire all my consultants. We draw you a plan. You know, let's say it's a beautiful Art Deco style building. They're like, okay. So then I take it down to the city and they'll reject me. And they'll say, well, you don't meet any of the design policy or standards. And it's like, what the hell does that mean? So you ask, and then they hand you a 500-page book and says, this is what your house or your building needs to look like. So it's basically back to the drawing board. So when you are trying to really do anything, your city, your municipality will tell you what essentially it can look like. So that's just in the case of, you know, me building your house on land that you own. Let's say that we do, you know, what I do. I buy a piece of land and I want to build an apartment. Well, there's this thing called zoning, which the city mandates, and it zones your property for a specific use. So let's say we go back to your lot and I want to buy it from you and I want to build, you know, let's say a 5-story apartment building. Well, technically your land isn't allowed for that use. So I have to go through the zoning process, which is essentially a political process. I have to notify all the neighbors. I have to get their approval. I have to get staff's approval. And then I also have to get the city council's approval. Now, the reason why it takes so long is because that period or that process that I just described can take anywhere from 12 to 18 months because you have legal notices, legal timelines, all of these things that you have to do or that you have to meet. Now, this will vary from city to city or state to state. some states like New York or California are very difficult to do this in. There's developers I've met from San Francisco where if it took me 2 years to get approval, it would take them 10, right? So there's all sorts of loops or hoops that you have to jump through in order to get anything done. And that's just to have the legal approval to build, you know, your five-story apartment building. Then on top of that, you've got to have your plans reviewed, and then there's the construction. So, you know, in that scenario, it could take you anywhere from 3 to 5 years just to build your five-story apartments. And that includes construction. But, you know, construction is also a little bit slower because of the various requirements and how complex it's become today. So the lag time that it takes, let's say, to build affordable apartments, because that's the hot button issue right now. Even if you wanted to build to meet supply, it would still take you years before you would have any product online. And that's, I guess, in direct opposition to how it was, you know, 125 years ago, where if you owned a piece of land, you had, you know, development rights just by right of owning the land. So if I was, you know, existed 125 years ago and I approached you, Spencer, and I said, you know what, we're going to bulldoze your house and we're going to build a beautiful mid-rise apartment building. You say, okay, when can we start? And I say, tomorrow. And there's nobody there to stop you. So the environment we live in today is much, much different.
Introducing the Gatekeepers Issue, the Q1 2023 print release from Bitcoin Magazine. The winter editorial serves as both a reminder of the sacrifice whistleblowers have made in the pursuit of truth and the call to arms for a new generation. Order it now from BitcoinMagazine.com. There is a thin line between curation and censorship. There is an even thinner line between moderation and constitutional violation. The Gatekeepers Issue explores the liminal space between these nuances, painting the fences worthy of demolition and those deserving respect. Bitcoin Magazine is for all Bitcoiners, the curious, convicted, and the maximalists. Subscribe today for exclusive interviews and profiles with leading Bitcoiners, actionable insights on the state of the market, breaking news and cultural trends, powerful photos, and artwork from the best artists in the world. Don't miss out on this piece of Bitcoin history. Subscribe now at store.bitcoinmagazine.com. Bitcoiners, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's both a free and paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com and embark on a path towards Bitcoin mastery. Get ready to seize every opportunity in the market with Bitcoin Magazine Pro today.
I think something that we could unpack a little bit more is, you know, what is kind of the fate of, you know, these types of systems? So like, to me, it sounds like, you know, there's this highly centralized way of deciding how the environment should evolve. We're kind of sidestepping the market process of, you know, distributing resources and allocating capital. And something that really caught my eye in your writing is you talk about the growth Ponzi as described by the Strong Towns thesis. And I know you can explain this better than I, but as I understand it, there is this mismatch between, you know, the liabilities that we're incurring as far as infrastructure, whether that's roads or sewage or electrical, and then, you know, the assets that we're able to create in what, you know, that could be the real estate that we're discussing. And so I think that would be a really interesting place to take it. Like, what is the state of things? Like, you know, we have this centrally planned mode of organizing cities, but it doesn't seem as though they're able to think very long term or with a lot of, I guess, risk management in play. So I was hoping you could unpack that growth Ponzi scenario. Like, how does that play into how the modern city has evolved?
Sure. So the growth Ponzi was coined by Charles Morone from Strong Towns. And what it discusses is the development patterns that we use today. So we are living in what he called the suburban experiment, which is where we build essentially subdivisions on the edges of town for people to buy homes and live in. Now, the difference between that and what we could call the traditional development pattern, which is what, you know, we kind of discussed how it was, how towns were built, you know, 100 plus years ago, is that through zoning and through land planning, which is central planning, they limit the use of land. So let's say that people favor single family homes, which they do. So they zone land for single family homes only. So what that does is that, you know, is what creates your home builders and all those other things, kind of like what my dad did for, you know, 35 years. Now, in order to have that subdivision exist, you have to bring essentially services and utilities to it. You have to pave a road to the new subdivision. You have to bring water, sewer, gas, telecom, and power. The problem is that once you get so many of these subdivisions spread out over such a large area, it actually costs more to maintain than it does to bring in revenue. So let's say, you know, you're a city, you're charging for water. If you have a traditionally designed town, then, you know, you may only have like 5, 10, 15 square miles in order to deal with. So you can bring services to all those people relatively cheaply and at quote unquote a profit. However, if you switch to the suburban design model, you've got to take infrastructure to an area almost 10 times the size while only charging, you know, certain amounts. So basically these subdivisions over time all lose money. Now that's mostly for the city and not necessarily for the individual that owns the home, right? Because they're the ones paying for the infrastructure. Theoretically, you pay all of these things through your property taxes, but they don't collect enough property tax in order to maintain, to pay for the maintenance. So a good example is a home that was built in 1975 has a bunch of infrastructure associated with it. After 25 years, all of that infrastructure has to be replaced. So the question is, over that 25-year span of time, did the city collect enough in revenue in order to replace it? The answer is no. So how do they survive? Well, over that 25-year span, more subdivisions have been built beyond that. So they take the money that they've earned from those new subdivisions to pay for the infrastructure of the old home. So that's where we get to the growth Ponzi scheme. In order to maintain prior infrastructure, you have to keep building new subdivisions, collecting new fees in order to pay for old things. So Charles describes it as after the third essential wave of construction, that the whole system collapses because there's just not enough money in order to pay for anything at that point. Because after 75 years, you now have three different cycles which have to be paid for, and there's no possible way you could ever build enough new subdivisions or new fees, or excuse me, collect enough new fees in order to pay for anything anymore. So that in a nutshell is what the growth Ponzi scheme is. Now, contrast this to traditional development patterns where you grow incrementally over time in an unplanned and unregulated manner. So essentially, private individuals will only build things that they know that they can take care of or pay for in maintenance. Another important aspect of the traditional development pattern is that you are using the land in more intense ways, right? So if you have an apartment building that's five stories, like a mid-rise building, instead of a single family home, there's more revenue and more wealth being created in that building that can support all of the infrastructure associated with it. So that is the long and the short version of why, you know, the growth Ponzi is bad. You just don't make enough money in order to maintain it. So now apply that to the US, where we've been doing that now. Basically, it started in Detroit in the 1930s. So we're going on 90 years since it started, and definitely since the 1950s post-World War II, when it really kicked off in earnest, both on a federal level and a state level. So we are at the cusp of the third the third ring of the Ponzi scheme here, where we've got to come up with all sorts of money just to maintain the neighborhoods we have.
And I mean, a lot of people's lived experiences in the United States is, you know, crumbling infrastructure, despite being, you know, quote unquote wealthiest country in the world. You know, going back to Europe, like when you go to Amsterdam, you really notice the organic nature in which the city kind of, you know, built on top of itself and sprawled, and you know, just how walkable and pleasant it is to be in the city. You also kind of notice how in Europe, you know, there's you know, urban environments and then there's rural environments, and there isn't really this kind of like gridded out middle ground. Kelly, do you kind of want to talk about, maybe tease out a little bit more about what the financing looks like, that had, you know, how that kind of changed as we went into, you know, the 1950s and 60s in the United States, and how that's, you know, really diverged from the past?
Sure. So it really kind of starts with the Great Depression and the outcome of how homes were financed as a result. So before the Great Depression, you had kind of what was essentially commercial terms. So you had a 7-year loan. Typically, when you bought a house, you put down 50%, and the total cost of your house was anywhere from 2 to 2.5 times your annual earnings. And that was it. There was no Fannie Mae, no Freddie Mac, no FHA. You know, if you wanted to buy a house, you could buy a house. And some of you guys may be familiar or have seen over time, like a Sears and Roebuck catalog, where they would send you, you know, you could buy a house for $2,500 and they would literally just ship it to you. And then you would put it together. So we started off with that. And then after the Great Depression, that's when I believe it was HUD that was founded. And they started doing 10-year loans where the government would guarantee the debt. So fast forward 20 years post World War II, one of the ideas for getting all the soldiers back on their feet and put to work was to essentially mandate a single family home construction as well as federal highways. So the federal highways are what really opened up the can of worms. Now, all of these things became essentially federally financed manifestations of fiat money, right? So that's really when everything started to become financialized. Then when you get into the early 60s, that's when they do 20-year federally insured home mortgages. And then finally, towards, I think it was the late 60s, early 70s, when the 30-year home mortgage was spawned. Now, none of this can exist, right, without being financed. Because if you are, you know, turning on the credit spigot, it's got to go somewhere. So there's lots of different laws and such that were passed over that time to kind of encourage or nudge users to build homes and buy homes and, you know, have the white picket fence, those sorts of things, like the American dream, which I call a PSYOP. But that's essentially how it all started. So by the time that the 70s were in full swing, all of these programs were pretty much ossified. And all that's happened since then is essentially, you know, playing around the edges of how the financing works. But it's kind of weird. If you talk to people who trade mortgage-backed securities or look at mortgage paper in general, a lot of those processes and the software are from, you know, the 70s or the 80s, where they still have to use, you know, blue screens in order to trade. So without the federally financed loans and, you know, the federal debt for highway expansion, all these things, the suburban development pattern just can't exist. The money's got to come from somewhere. So they essentially just print it.
And Kelly, or I guess CK, if you want to hop in here, but I was just going to ask.
Go for it.
Yeah. So I want to try to understand like how these development patterns have changed over time. So I guess my perspective on it is that it seems like the little guy has kind of been pushed to the side as far as being able to dictate what their, you know, highly local built environment looks like. You know, there's just so many zoning regulations, things you have to do, things you can't do. And all of this bureaucracy and paperwork has kind of pushed that decision making up to large firms that have the capital available to, you know, make their way through that bureaucracy, craft those political ties and all of that. And kind of as I see it, it just seems like, you know, so much of development is like, you know, gigantic, you know, plots of land, you know, really large, I guess, homogenized ways of creating neighborhoods. So does that relate at all to the financialization? Like, kind of where I'm going with this is, like, is it those with, you know, the best access to cheap debt that are, you know, able to create and construct the built environments? And it seems like, you know, those at the bottom of the fiat pyramid really don't have that access. So, like, do you see as something like that going on? Like, is there a homogenization of, you know, the people that are able to build? And, you know, what is the impact of that?
Yeah, 100%. Yes. So what you have, I guess, in the real estate development or construction space is essentially what you have everywhere else, right? So real estate is really a game of finance and essentially managing numbers and managing debt. So you can think of it closer to banking, really, than anything else. So over time, you used to have, you know, tens of thousands of banks, and now you're down to, less than 100, just being facetious. But it's the same idea. So as financialization, we'll say accrues, as financialization accrues, so does the requirements for someone to develop land, right? So when you see large projects, 500, 600 unit apartment projects, or, you know, 100 story buildings, that takes a serious amount of capital and a, you know, also concentration of know-how, ability, and essentially power, because, you know, real estate development is also a very, very political game. So, you know, how did we get to that point? Well, we can go all the way back to like 1904 or 1906, when the first essential zoning ordinance was passed in New York City to prevent buildings from being, I don't know, maybe it was like 30 stories tall, because the street wasn't getting any quote unquote light, right? So those kind of ordinances were passed over time, and they were struck down by different courts until 1927, when you had a case called Euclid versus Amber. And there's a guy who owned Ambler Real Estate, and he was trying to build a hotel on a main drag in Euclid, Ohio. And the city told him no, he needed to move the front of his building back 10 feet from the street. That's called a setback. So you need to set your building back 10 feet from the street so people can walk in front of it. And he told him to go pound sand, and it made it all the way to the Supreme Court. And if anybody wants just total brain damage reading something that you just can't believe happened, you should read the Supreme Court's decision in Ambler v. Euclid. But to continue on, that's where modern zoning was born. So what is zoning? Zoning is where you, as the government, as your, you know, local city, decide what kinds of uses can be in what areas. So you zone a specific area for a specific kind of use. So that can be industrial, commercial, residential, or special use. There's a couple others, but they're not very important. So, you know, over time, it used to be, you know, limited to like, well, you can only build residential here, or you can build commercial, or you can build industrial. Now it's like, well, you can only build, you know, type one residential 4,000. So that's one, you know, one unit, one house per every 4,000 square feet of land. Now, over time, you know, it's just growing from one version to another. And really all it does is just get more complicated. So it's a funny game of musical chairs. Every couple of years, there's a committee called the International Building Code Committee, and there's various subsets of it. So it's, you know, there's fire, plumbing, electrical, and depending on who wants to be in charge, different organizations will have more control over the process than others. So like right now, fire has way more control over development than, you know, anybody else. So goodness. What really happens is that over time you become more and more limited, so that the smaller guy has a higher, what's the word I'm looking for?
Barrier to entry cost.
Yeah, there you go. So the barrier to entry goes higher and higher over time. So if you were, you know, you still have rights to like build your own home, and that'll vary from state to state. You just have to go through the process. Now you can get consultants and zoning attorneys to help you with that. But if you wanted to say, like, try and compete with me, you know, never having done it before, I would tell you to, you know, probably stick with your day job. It's a very intense, it's a very specific process. I mean, for any one job, you know, you have at least two or three attorneys plus, you know, however many consultants are required in order to design a building. So there may be dozens of consultants that I you know, employ through the business in order just to build, you know, 20 apartments. And that process will take me, you know, 12 to 18 months. So really over time, you have to centralize as you have to centralize capital and you have to centralize essentially the ability to just do it. If you were a small guy and you wanted to build an apartment complex, you are going to have a really hard time today. And that'll vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But yeah, I would not recommend it unless you really, really love real estate construction and brain damage.
So, Kelly, obviously you're on the inside of the beast. You're also a Bitcoiner. You've seen, you know, the negative implications of, you know, the incentives that have kind of been built up since World War II. Talk to us about how can it be different? It sounds like strong towns is a big influence. Why don't you tell us about, you know, that theory?
Sure. So where we can start with that, especially with strong towns, is kind of realizing that the built environment that you have today is destroying wealth. So as Bitcoiners, you know, we mostly agree that the creation of wealth is a good and positive outcome of human action, right? So by creating value and turning a profit, that means that you did something beneficial for somebody else that they're willing to pay you for. So with all the red tape that exists today, that makes it very difficult, right? So there's fewer and fewer people, like I said, that can do these things. The environment that I would love to live in is one where I can buy a piece of property and build, you know, an apartment or a mixed use building. How we get there is, in my opinion, through the strong towns method of realizing and doing the math for, does this subdivision actually even pay for itself? Or does this building pay for itself? You know, can the city afford to replace the sewer line or the water line in 25 years that services this building? Now today in subdivisions that the answer is no, but if you're in older parts of town, that answer is yes. So really anything built before 1940, basically before World War II, pays for itself. There's a fantastic organization called Urban 3, and they've partnered with strong towns for a long time. But what they do is they comb through the tax data of various cities, and they produce three-dimensional graphs, probably isn't a good word, but it's a three-dimensional overlay of a city with every single parcel. And they do so showing whether or not the city produces positive economic outcomes or negative economic outcomes. So if you had positive outcomes, there'd be a green bar graph above the property. And if you had negative economic outcomes, there would be a red line below that property. So what they're able to determine is that areas built before 1940 produce wealth and basically pay for all of the development that was built afterwards. So, I mean, yeah, that kind of data and the arguments that you're able to make with that data are the starting point for essentially turning the ship around, right? So is there a lot of economic damage, in my opinion, that's been done? Absolutely. It's very difficult to turn, you know, an existing subdivision into something else, because you have to remember that there's all sorts of infrastructure that's already in the streets or above the streets, above ground. And you've got to remove all that and basically start over. And that's very difficult. So I think as a Bitcoiner, you know, everybody has their challenges, so to speak, for their generation or their times. And I think that for me, that's one of them. It's getting people to understand that the situation that we're in, making good arguments with even better data, and trying to, you know, stop the destruction of wealth for cities, you know, because if a city can't afford to maintain, you know, water and sewer lines, everybody's in a whole lot of trouble.
So Kelly, just to kind of like build on that, you know, I think the United States and maybe Canada are really in this predicament more than many other places, where so much of like the existing urban environment and, you know, suburban sprawl was kind of like done in this window of fiat. Can you kind of just talk about like maybe your, like what does kind of coming out of that look like in the U.S.?
By coming out of it, do you mean, I guess?
I guess like, you know, how does a place like Phoenix, you know, become a city that, you know, mathematically makes sense?
Oof.
Yeah, well, I also think it'd be interesting to hear, like, you know, it sounds like there's all of this development that's built on, you know, the promise of like open-ended growth. You need to keep the Ponzi going. And, you know, a lot of these developments are built on foundations of sand. And so, like, you know, what happens when those foundations start to give way? And like, how does that transitionary period look like?
Well, I guess from my experience, what that transition looks like is that cities are essentially unable to pay for the infrastructure that you've been paying taxes on forever. So what they do is they essentially change the rules and say that if any infrastructure has to be replaced, they, you know, they will do what's called a special assessment. So instead of using the tax money, or I guess using the tax money that you gave them and it not being enough, they'll just charge you more for it. So then you come into a situation where if you have to pay another $50,000 in order for the sewer line, you know, to your subdivision to get replaced, you're more than likely just going to sell the house in order to raise the money. So what you'll get is a bunch of people moving and selling their properties in order to pay those bills. But who's going to buy it knowing that that's how the city acts, right? So if the new buyer comes in and sees, you know, when they bought the property that there's a special assessment for $50,000 to replace the sewer, you know, they may not be inclined to stay. They may sell and try and move. I think what you have over time is that process repeated to a point where somebody gets caught or stuck with holding the real estate bag and the property being worthless. So then, you know, you're in a situation where the city's not servicing the lot because there's nobody paying for it. And there's not enough money to replace any specific, you know, utilities or infrastructure. Like there's no one to go out there and repave the street, right? Because they don't have any money to do it. So I think over time they'll be forced to acknowledge that what they're doing is wrong. And not in this like a moral sense, just in the fact that like it doesn't work. You can't pay for any of this stuff. And how that gets fixed is literally just block by block. You got to go back and people will, I don't want to say, you know, collapse in on the inner city in order to survive. But, you know, if you're a developer and you're seeing this stuff happening, if it were me, I would go as close to the center of town as possible and basically, you know, start over, start building it one building by one building. And, you know, with the specific goal of being financially productive. Now is that, you know, obviously I can't do that everywhere and I can't fix Phoenix entirely by myself, but I think that as knowledge is distributed, that will become a greater method and means in order to fix things. So this kind of goes back. It'll go from being a centralized activity where there's few players that can essentially navigate and deal with the system as it is today, back to being a distributed and decentralized development system where there may be hundreds or thousands of people like me, you know, doing hundreds or thousands of buildings at a time, trying to fix the city.
Yeah. And I think like personally, just that like decentralization of economic activity just makes so much more sense using the market process to allocate resources. And, you know, one thing that really comes to mind for me is this idea of the doorman fallacy. So like in the context of real estate development, it would be, you know, you have a bunch of consultants and central planners from outside of this locale being like, okay, we need to serve this end that we have in mind. How can we get there the most efficiently? And they're like, okay, well, we're going to start cutting costs. And like in the context of the doorman, it's going to be, you know, say you're running a hotel and then these consultants come in and say, okay, well, you pay the doorman $15 an hour, but if we install an elevator, you know, it's going to be, you know, the equivalent of $10 an hour. So we can save you money and improve, quote unquote, your hotel. Yet what they're not taking into account is the true value of having somebody there. You know, people appreciate having a doorman at the hotel or the housing complex that's going to, you know, first of all, make them feel safe, greet them, help build the community. You know, there's friendship involved. There's like all of these things, this, I guess, like, you know, in the context of urban planning, there's like all of this cultural capital. And when you, you know, impose central planning, it seems as though so much of that is unable to be taken into account because of that centralization of decision making. And, you know, I went to school in New Orleans. I also spent some time in Amsterdam, and it's really interesting to see how those two cities differ. But like in the context of New Orleans, there was the I-10 freeway that was built. And this was on like a section in North Claiborne, I believe. And it was, you know, a rather disadvantaged part of the city. And, you know, the city was like, okay, well, we have this end goal in mind of improving the highway system. So we're going to, you know, go where it's politically expedient. You know, they go to these disadvantaged communities and, you know, cut down all the oak trees and, you know, level a lot of the area to make way for this roadway. And what they end up doing is destroying the cultural capital that existed there. They fragment these communities, make them much less pleasant. And, you know, what I had my eye on too is like they destroyed a lot of nature. And so when I'm thinking about what a more decentralized future in terms of how we construct the built environment could be, you know, I really want to know, like, what role does like natural capital and cultural capital play? Like in the context of, you know, building stronger cities, like, how do you see that coming into play? Like, it feels like now we have like a monoculture of white picket fences and lawns, whereas, you know, in the future, hopefully we could have, you know, a polyculture of, you know, diverse types of plants, diverse types of, you know, I guess, cultural affiliations that could kind of self-organize in a more organic way. So like, to I guess, just to kind of paint us a better picture of, you know, what does that future potentially look like? Like, what are the benefits of having this more decentralized way of allocation?
Sure. And it's today, the result of the different policies and ordinances and zoning and things that exist today are absolutely homogenous. So when you think about nature or plants and all these things, if you've seen a modern American subdivision, there's, you know, a very limited variety of nature. And that's quite literally because it's regulated that way. The places that you like to go, the plants that you like to see in different developments, especially new ones, are quite literally regulated that way. So, you know, that could be good, could be bad. Like I live in Phoenix, and a good example would be like, you know, from 50 years ago, people used to plant ponderosa pine trees down here. And it just looks absolutely awful because without them being there, they don't naturally occur here, right? You have mesquite trees or Palo Verde trees, saguaro cacti, different versions of smaller cacti, all of these different, I guess you'd call biodiversity in existing nature. So when you are building or developing today, you're limited to what, you know, your landscape architect puts on the plans. And what they put on the plans is essentially what their reading is of, you know, the design policy manual, right? Now there is some, what's the word I'm looking for? There is some lateral ability that you have in designing places like this, but you also have to remember that it comes down to cost. If I like saguaros, which are naturally occurring in this part of the country, if I wanted to put one in, it would cost me probably tens of thousands of dollars. So am I going to spend tens of thousands of dollars on one saguaro, or am I going to spend $10,000 for, you know, 20 trees, right? Even though they may be year old saplings or whatever. You know, that's the decision that's going to be made. Now, to compare that to the doorman, yes, is it a better modality, you know, for building in the Southwest to put in a saguaro? Sure, absolutely. Is there a reason why it's expensive? Sure, absolutely. But, you know, when it comes to decentralizing and adding biodiversity or just diversity in general, actual diversity, it comes down to the fact that there's not a decentralized organization or decentralized group of people making those decisions, right? They're not making value judgments for the work that they're doing or the building that they're building or the community or the park that they want to build in their neighborhood. It's all top down. So if you wanted to do something in your city, you want to build a park, good luck. Got to go petition the city in order to do it. And then you've got all the problems associated with that. So if you know, the real way back to the kind of building diversity that you're talking about is literally dismantling, you know, the top-down structures that exist along with the processes that are a part of them. And I would love to, you know, I guess I love being a part of that process with, you know, this education.
No, totally. And I mean, that's kind of why, you know, we do Cosmic Bitcoin, because people don't really necessarily think about the implications of, like, how dismantling those control structures changes the environment around them. But it does. And, you know, the impacts of macro things like the nature of our money, you've done such an eloquent job of kind of explaining how that materializes in the spaces that we live. Kelly, do you want to kind of talk about, you know, your vision of Bitcoin fixing this? You know, you kind of teased a little bit on, you know, how things break apart until finally builders are in position to kind of build back in a decentralized way. But just talk to us about, how does Bitcoin fix this?
Oh, my favorite part. So how Bitcoin fixes this, in my mind is with a limited capital set, right? So you have your pool of capital is limited to Bitcoin and the 21 million, and then the associated value with those coins. So this is, as we all know, essentially the antithesis of credit money, fiat money, all of that put together. So real estate is highly Cantillon, and the fact that a lot of times capital's either, well, basically real estate is financed directly from banks. Banks can't get any closer to the Cantillon effect other than being the Federal Reserve themselves. So by transitioning to a Bitcoin standard, you remove a lot of the ability for banks to essentially willy-nilly finance real estate. So real estate is one of the largest holdings of banks in general in terms of loans and loan books. So on a Bitcoin standard, it's basically impossible to do that. So there's very little equity financing compared to the debt financing when it comes to, you know, building an apartment building and then continuing to own it, right? So by reducing the size of outstanding debts and moving more towards an equity solution where investors are putting in money as opposed to getting money from a bank, I think you'll be able to turn the ship around. I think there's going to be a lot of damage done financially to cities just because this is how they've literally operated for about 100 years now. So, you know, but out of the chaos comes opportunity. And I really think that adopting a Bitcoin standard will force developers, builders, neighbors, and the city itself to rethink what their built environment looks like. Because you have to remember, a lot of this stuff continues to exist today because, people depend on their home as a form of savings and retirement. So if you are, you know, let's say a boomer, and you've got a house and you've got, you know, all sorts of equity, if you've got hundreds of thousands of equity built up, the last thing that you want is, you know, something new going down the street that will potentially pull down your property value and destroy your retirement, right? So a lot of what we have today is a result of, you know, people picketing or picking fights or denying jobs because they feel like they're going to lose their wealth. Bitcoin helps that because it essentially drains away the value associated with real estate. So over time, real estate's essentially no longer a store of value or an inflation hedge. It becomes more of an asset that produces a return as opposed to an asset that you play debt games with, right? So the biggest thing for me in my vision is essentially removing the debt games associated with real estate, removing the store of value aura, we'll call it, around real estate. And I think that the best way to do that is slowly and allows people to adjust over time, maybe stack some corn instead of stacking some bricks. But I hope for basically all our sakes that it doesn't happen overnight, because that would be very bad for all involved. It's one of those things. I agree with what Parker Lewis says, is that, you know, it's the distribution of knowledge over time which is going to make Bitcoin obsolete all other money. And it's the over time part that is really important for real estate, because it's a very slow moving industry, and it's very tied into you know, TradFi or legacy finance when it comes to essentially existing. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
Kelly, I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a really fascinating conversation, diving into some topics that people I don't think necessarily thought about, you know, are a response to money or implications to money, as well as, you know, what Bitcoin could do to our surrounding environments, our urban environments. Before we get into giving you the last word, you know, I want to encourage people, you know, listening to consider Bitcoin Amsterdam this October 12th to the 13th. We're going to have a lot of cosmic conversations there in one of the most incredible cities, one of the homes of finance, the birthplace of modern banking, and just really an incredible event in an incredible city and just a really awesome place. An awesome urban environment to be with Bitcoiners. So check that out. Ticket prices go up this Friday. So this is the ultimate opportunity to get ticket prices at pre-sale prices, and you can even bundle it with the Bitcoin 2024 ticket for the best pricing package possible. But great speakers already announced. JB55 from the Domus app, Stella Assange, and many more to be announced very, very soon. Our programming team is very hard at work. But that is enough housekeeping, enough about the Bitcoin conference. We're going to be back next Wednesday with another incredible conversation, getting cosmic. And yeah, Spencer, any last words from you before I hand it back to Kelly?
No, yeah, I mean, I just kind of wanted to give Kelly the opportunity to talk about anything he's working on. So Kelly, I know you mentioned a couple of things that you wanted to bring up on this show, and one of those is a Bitcoin mortgage program that you mentioned, and as well as the importance of craftsmanship. So if either of those, you know, appeal to you as kind of a talking point for you, I would love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So I've been working on essentially a collaborative custody version of a Bitcoin mortgage for a couple of years now. There's been lots of different hurdles and no's and stuff, but I'm inching closer and closer to giving the people what they want, it seems. So I'm really hoping that now that we're crawling out of the bear market and things are settling down in the housing market, although not as much as we're in the direction of what people would like. But I continue carry on with trying to bring that to the people. Then one other thing that, you know, I've been working on and thinking about a lot is how particularly craftsmanship has changed over the last 100 years from a gold standard to a fiat standard, and hopefully how it will look on a Bitcoin standard. I think that craftsmanship, at least in, you know, my realm of real estate, is sorely lacking from my experience, and I'm hoping to think through that and provide some value and knowledge. So I just wanted to thank everybody for being here today and listening to not exactly always everybody's favorite subject of real estate, because real estate is a shitcoin after all. But just wanted to thank everybody for being here. And if you have questions, you see my Twitter handle here, or sign up for the newsletter, pester me with questions. Otherwise, you know, thank you for being here and thank you for having me on. It was a wonderful time.
Yeah, thank you, Kelly. Really, really appreciate you sharing your knowledge with our audience. And I'll also just encourage everyone, give Kelly a follow. And up in the Nest as well, we have a link to his Bitcoin Urbanism Substack. So if you want to understand a little bit more of the thought process behind what we discussed today, it's you know, great wealth of knowledge and a lot of great citations too that'll take you on some fun rabbit holes related to, you know, fiat architecture versus sound money architecture. I found super interesting. And on that note of craftsmanship, I gotta say I'm optimistic. Hopefully, you know, as we get back to a free market process, we can have a little bit more specialization of labor. You don't have, we want to have people, you know, gambling on shit coins. We'll have people working on their skills to provide value. So hopefully, you know, we can get some craftsmanship up and running in the future. But yeah, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us on Cosmic Bitcoin. Really appreciate it. And CK, any parting words for us before we get out of here?
Stack sats, be humble, go subscribe to Kelly's newsletter, and come to Bitcoin Amsterdam. That's all I got. Peace.
Peace out, y'all. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Likewise.
Thank you, Miami, for the last 3 years in this amazing city. The whole world shut down, but Miami welcomed us with open arms. We want to show Bitcoin to the whole world. We are taking the conference on the road to set the stage for Bitcoin in a new city. Nashville. Bitcoin 2024 is coming to Nashville in Tennessee, a city that is known as a music and freedom city. Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville from July 25th to 27th.
My fellow plebs, Bitcoin Magazine is headed back to Amsterdam in 2023. We're returning to Westergaas to build on this historic success and continue our mission of global hyper-Bitcoinization. In its inaugural year, Bitcoin Amsterdam was the biggest European Bitcoin event in history. Held from October 12th to the 14th at Westergaas Event Forum, nearly 3,000 attendees jumped at the opportunity to learn, engage, and party with fellow Bitcoiners. 126 brilliant speakers from all over Europe and beyond took the stage to represent different angles and present various perspectives. Offering 6 different on-site locations and 3 fully programmed stages, we are absolutely stoked to catapult the European community to the global stage. Tickets are at their lowest prices right now. Lock yours in at b.tc/conference/Amsterdam. That's b.tc/conference/Amsterdam.